Hello and welcome to AMSSM Sports Medcast. As we approach the 2024 AMSSM annual meeting in Baltimore, Maryland, we continue our mini journal club series highlighting each of the top articles in sports and exercise medicine from 2022, as selected from last spring's annual meeting in Phoenix. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy Schroeder, Sports and Exercise Medicine at Madigan Army Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington. I am joined today by Dr. Scott Paradise, a member of the Top Articles Subcommittee, which is part of the AMSSM Education Committee. Welcome, Scott.
Hey, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Paradise is a sports and exercise medicine physician in the United States Navy and currently serving as a regimental physician for the 2nd Marine Regiment at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. He graduated from Penn State University College of Medicine and completed his family medicine residency at AT Augusta Military Medical Center at Fort Belvoir, followed by a fellowship at the Naval Hospital Camp Pendleton in sports and exercise medicine. He currently holds a faculty appointment as assistant professor of family medicine at the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland, and additionally serves as clinical faculty at the Naval Hospital Camp Lejeune Primary Care Sports Medicine Fellowship. Scott, it is so great to have you back once again. Welcome back to the AMSSM Sports Medcast.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jeremy. Appreciate it. The re-invitation to be here.
So today we have on our books, as we continue down that top five countdown, we have the number three and number two top articles that were unveiled at last year's annual meeting. The first one we're going to cover today is by Gianola et al. In the January 22 issue of British Journal of Sports Medicine entitled Effectiveness of Treatments for Acute and Subacute Mechanical Non-specific low back pain. This is a systematic review with meta-analysis. Now, Scott, low back pain is absolutely ubiquitous in the healthcare system, especially at the primary care level and in our settings in the military health system. So what went into this systematic review and what did it set out to investigate?
As you mentioned, Jeremy, low back pain is incredibly common. It's one of the most common presentations to primary care clinics. Approximately 80% of military members at some point will present to their primary care clinic with low back pain. And it can be a condition that starts acutely and can end up lasting for a long, long time. Now, most acute low back pain does improve within the short term, within about 6-8 weeks or so on average. If we look at a lot of trials, we see that 6-8 week improvement. However, a large portion of those patients still have some pain at 3 months and at 12 months as well. When we think about back pain, when I see a patient in my clinic with back pain, I always try to reassure them. You know, I'll look for the red flags, look for any dangerous or systemic or curable causes of low back pain. But largely, I'm reassuring my patients and getting them to engage in some subthreshold exercises as early as possible or as early as they can. And that's really supported by the guidelines pretty consistently across guideline statements. But, you know, in addition to those two things, there's like a million things that we can do for back pain, whether that's dry needling, stretches, physical therapy referrals, you know, NSAIDs, Tylenol, you know, the list goes on. And we don't know a lot about how those treatments compare to one another, especially when it comes to that transitional piece from acute back pain to subacute or chronic back pain even. So that's what these authors tried to discover when they performed this network meta-analysis.
And now we talk about this systematic review, network meta-analysis, and some systematic reviews have just a few RCTs, but this has quite a few to it. So looking at the vast number of RCTs, we want to try to compare apples to apples. Can you run us through how many RCTs, what the criteria were for inclusion, exclusion, and what it involved as far as any interventions, treatments, et cetera?
This systematic review was particularly robust in its record collection. They included 46 trials. They all had to be randomized trials. They had to include a pharmacologic or non-pharmacologic treatment and a placebo comparator. You know, you mentioned, Jeremy, comparing apples to apples. And, you know, I almost kind of think with network meta-analysis that the benefit of this tool is it almost allows us to compare apples to oranges. And I'll explain what I mean by that. When you have like your classic pairwise meta-analysis, you're taking all treatments of a specific intervention and a comparator, right? When we line up our PICO question, we have one intervention, one comparator, and we're comparing that across the entire meta-analysis. A network meta-analysis is kind of special in the sense that it can take, you know, trial one, which compares A to B, and trial two that compares B to C, and it can allow you to compare A to C using what we call an indirect comparison. Again, just allowing you to compare multiple treatment arms against each other that you don't necessarily have the trials for, if that makes sense. You know, it also allows us within that to do something called ranking of treatments, right? In the network meta-analysis realm, we call this SUCRA, or surface under the cumulative ranking curve. But all it is it's just we're a ranked probability of, you know, which treatment is the most likely to be effective for the given condition. So again, network meta-analysis, really cool tools that we're seeing more and more of, allowing us to compare multiple treatments, not necessarily compare directly against each other in the literature.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think that really is a helpful tool, like you mentioned, to help us in the clinical realm of better discernment and being able to extrapolate some of the data more. So with Gianola's team, what were some of the primary and secondary outcomes that they look to assess?
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. I realize I can get on my own little tangents sometimes when talking about some of these scientific methods.
That's great.
I never really answered your question.
That's why we're here.
This study, it really looked at those acute or subacute patients with low back pain, so back pain that had been present for less than 12 weeks, and it evaluated their outcomes from 1 week after inclusion all the way up to 12 months. So it was a full time frame of outcome measures from the very immediate time frames, 1 week, all the way up to kind of that chronic transitional time frame of, you know, 6 or 12 months. They looked at exercise, they looked at heat wrap, manual therapy, NSAIDs, opioids, Tylenol, a lot of treatments that we commonly use for low back pain to try and figure out which ones are most likely at having benefit and at which time points.
Perfect. So out of all this, we have lots of data that came in that was put through this meta-analysis. So of all those different interventions, did anything seem to come out on top?
Yeah, so what they did find is that they found that exercise, heat wrap, manual therapy, NSAIDs, and opioids all improved pain and disability at the immediate term, 1 week. And exercise was the most likely to improve pain. And when we say exercise, we're talking motor control and McKenzie-type exercises were the exercises they're including in this meta-analysis. Manual therapy was the most likely to improve disability. The other thing about manual therapy, it was the only treatment that was still superior to placebo in improving pain at 1 month and 3 to 6 months after somebody came in with acute or subacute low back pain. I mean, in fact, it was the only superior treatment, like I said, superior to placebo after 1 week. The other sort of less exciting or I guess pessimistic result of this trial or meta-analysis was that no treatments demonstrated significant improvement at the 12-month mark in disability or in pain control, which again can be frustrating at times when we're trying to think of those early treatments to affect the long-term natural history of low back pain.
So then ultimately, after we look at the data of all the different things, we talk about the exercise, manual therapy, heat wrap, education, pharmacologic interventions. At the end of the day, all this data, what do we do with it? You know, how can this study, which is one of our top three article, how does it impact us in the clinical setting and how we are approaching this very common condition of mechanical low back pain?
It's a very good question, Jeremy. This study, even though it doesn't give us much information on how to affect the natural history or long-term course of low back pain at the 12-month mark, it does offer us a lot of good treatment options superior to placebo in the very short term, the 1 week and even a few months mark. What is important to note about the way these network meta-analysis work is that when they do these super rankings, they don't give us a lot of information about the magnitude of effect, just that their probability of working. And so, you know, when I see somebody in my clinic, again, kind of going back to the start of the episode here, you know, I'm not just telling them exercise and it'll get better with time, you know, I'm usually trying to leverage multiple treatment strategies. And so this gives us a lot of treatment strategies or a larger pool to really pull from when we're counseling our patients. Like I said earlier, though, that unfortunately, we still haven't really figured out that single treatment that when initiated early on can alter the long-term course of non-specific low back pain.
I think it's a perfect summary that we need to use that education. These can be helpful tools. We're looking at sometimes short-term gains while we're looking at some of the foundations of the rehab. And as you mentioned on the outset, you know, a significant amount of patients will just spontaneously recover from their back pain, whether we do anything or not. You know, our job sometimes is to help with those short-term quality of life points. And I did find it interesting that, again, acetaminophen failed to show any significant benefit at any point. And that's something that we reach for on a regular basis, especially for those who may not have great experiences with NSAIDs. And can you speak a little bit on that?
Yeah, surprising, like you mentioned, acetaminophen did not show benefit above placebo, at least in this network meta-analysis, at any time point. So 1 week, couple months, 12 months, any time point. I earlier mentioned the NSAIDs and the opioids did show benefit, the other pharmacologic options included in here. However, they also showed a high rate of side effects, right? So 1 in 2, or about 50% of patients receiving NSAIDs or opioids experiencing adverse reactions to those drugs. So, you know, while they do work, you know, at least in this network meta-analysis, they only show benefit over placebo and at the 1 week time frame. And they're associated with significant harms too. Now, this study doesn't really go in too much about what those harms were or the severity of them, but they're meaningful side effects and that they're happening to 1 out of 2 of the study population.
Thanks for wrapping that one up. I think that's a really good study. But we're followed right back up with another fantastic article, our number 2 top article. And this is another systematic review and meta-analysis. This one published in the journal Osteoarthritis and Cartilage in their December 2022 issue by authors Donovan et al., entitled The Effects of Recurrent Intra-Articular Corticosteroid Injections for Osteoarthritis at 3 Months and Beyond. So again, going from low back pain to osteoarthritis, something that we also see on a regular routine basis. And CSIs have been a staple of osteoarthritis care for a long, long time. However, there are some growing concerns regarding the safety of repetitive steroid injections. So, Scott, can you start off by just talking about the paper's main clinical question here?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, as you mentioned, you know, if you want to start a controversy at a musculoskeletal medicine convention, just mention a preference for steroid or orthobiologics in the treatment of osteoarthritis. And, you know, quickly we'll start some heated conversation. Like you mentioned, steroid injections are the most common injection that we see in primary care and musculoskeletal medicine clinics. Without sounding too controversial, they do have a place in medicine for sports injuries and for arthritis. But like you also said, we have emerging evidence that repetitive, high volume steroid injections can increase our risk of osteoarthritis. And you know, the famous study that comes to mind is that McLendon study from 2017 in JAMA, which compared triamcinolone and saline. Patients received 8 injections over a 2-year period. They measured MRI cartilage width, and they found that, you know, if the steroid group loses cartilage at a rate that's 2 times faster than the saline group. If the saline placebo group lost about 5% of their cartilage thickness, the steroid group lost 10%, right? But what that same study did not see was a change in patient reported outcomes. So the pain and function in that McLendon study at 2 years at least was unchanged after 8 close interval steroid injections. And that's important, right? If I decrease your cartilage volume by 10% versus 5%, am I actually changing the patient's experience of osteoarthritis, which is really at the end of the day what I care about, as opposed to, you know, some number of millimeters of cartilage in someone's knee. And so Donovan and his team really sought to answer that question, or at least see if they could answer that question from the available literature. do recurrent steroid injections alter symptoms or patient experience of osteoarthritis with regards to pain and function at time points beyond the very short term of 3 months? So that was sort of the genesis of this systematic review.
Perfect. So once they had their clinical question to set out to investigate, they put together the systematic review. What did that, how was that constructed? What did it include? And what do they look at?
Right. So their literature search yielded 10 randomized trials. They had to be a randomized trial to be included. 8 of those were evaluating knee OA, and 2 were evaluating trapezio-metacarpal OA or hand OA. And when we think about, you know, the kind of volume of osteoarthritis studies, that's not too atypical, right? A lot of our research and a lot of our data that we use to counsel patients actually does come from knee arthritis. And that's a, you know, a small amount was performed in hand arthritis is not too unreasonable. But, you know, nonetheless, you know, important to note when we're thinking about the generalizability of this systematic review. Patients received between 2 and 8 injections, 1 week to 3 months apart, mostly 1 to 2 weeks apart. And a couple of studies were trended towards the 3 month mark. And the comparators included hyaluronic acid, saline, PRP, and Orgodian, a sort of superoxide dismutase, which is this kind of reactive oxygen species scavenger thought to be involved in the pathogenesis of arthritis, which came from a study out of Sweden in 1984. So a little bit of heterogeneity in the makeup of these articles, but nonetheless gets that kind of primary intervention of steroid across all records.
Was the inclusion of both knee and hand OA by design, or were they just trying to get more numbers overall?
They did not specify in their inclusion criteria that it had to be knee or hand OA, but that's what they came up with in their literature search. I think they did a good job in their analysis of separating those two where appropriate and saying that these are the outcomes that we got for knee OA and these are the outcomes we got for hand OA. You know, like I said, the knee OA seems to be the prevalent condition in the research base. And so, you know, given that 8 of the 10 studies were knee OA, is probably more representative of the research body at large.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting to me, the inclusion that I talked to patients about knee OA, and we talk about force loads being a weight-bearing joint and so forth, and the impact that that has, but also try to provide that education where, hey, there's like systemic inflammation and goes throughout, and, you know, talk about the role of other tissues such as adipose on inflammatory markers contributing. And we've seen some studies where those that have a BMI greater than 30 have increased risk of hand OA, even though it's not a weight-bearing joint. So I thought that was kind of an interesting inclusion. Overall, when we break that down and looking at this numbers here of nearly 1,000 total patients between the 10 RCTs, what do they find in comparison to their questions regarding pain and function?
So largely they found that all arms improved in function and pain, but what they found that for the most part at 3 to 6 months, that improvement was greater in the comparator, i.e. the non-steroid group, and kind of partially disappeared at the long-term, but was definitely apparent at the 3 to 6 month mark.
In my clinical practice, you know, I see the greatest benefit with corticosteroids within those 3 months and didn't see as much of a fall. You see the 3, 6, 9, 12 follow-up, and we're seeing that, yeah, there's not an advantage with corticosteroids at those indicators, but maybe not as much assessed before that 3 month period where we typically expect to see good benefits with corticosteroids.
Mm-hmm. And remember that the authors here were trying to figure out the long-term patient-oriented effects of steroid. And so a lot of my patients will walk out the room happy that I injected their knee, or they'll come back in a month for a different issue and they'll say their knees are doing great. But, you know, really what we care about for a lot of our patients who aren't ready for a knee arthroplasty is how are they doing at 6 months and how are they doing at 12 months? Unfortunately, we don't have like a very clear signal, regardless of what comparator injection we're using, that we have superiority at the 12 to 24 months. But for some pain and some function across a smaller number of studies that went out that far, it does seem to be that the steroid groups performed either equal to or inferior to the comparator injection.
So now as we culminate our analysis of this study, what is your bottom line recommendations for the listener as we're trying to digest this study and make it applicable to how we're talking to our patients?
Right. So I think the overall conclusions we can draw from the study is that recurrent steroid injections may provide inferior symptom relief in that medium term, right? The post 2 to 3 month analysis, you know, at 3 and 6 and 9 months. But we're not really sure about the really long term, the 12 and 24 month period. And I would even extrapolate that we still don't know what happens at 5 years or 10 years. Are patients more bothered by arthritis symptoms at 10 years if they receive frequent steroid injections than they would be if they had either not received any injections or a comparator injection like PRP or hyaluronic acid, right? We also don't know how this affects your risk of early arthroscopy or an early arthroplasty, right? So if I give you 8 knee injections now, are you going to have your total knee arthroplasty at 40 years old instead of 60 years old? You know, we don't know the answer to that question. We also don't know how recurrent knee injections affect your long-term risk of an infection or a prosthetic joint infection if you are to get surgery. So still a lot of unanswered questions, but that this area or the space in the literature is really developing pretty rapidly. And I think in a few more years, we may come to those answers as we get a little bit more data.
Wow, Scott, thank you so much. This is really cool delving into this. I personally feel greatly edified going through and hashing out these awesome articles with you. Again, looking at the treatments of acute, subacute, low back pain, and then this number 2 article on intra-articular corticosteroid injections for osteoarthritis, looking more at the 3 months and beyond. I really appreciate you taking us along the journey of these articles and hopefully making it more clinically relevant as we continue our care of our athletes and our patients across the globe.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Love chatting with you.
I'd like to thank Dr. Scott Paradise from the AMSSM Top Articles Committee. Links to these articles can be found in our podcast show notes. I'd also like to thank you, the listener. I hope you have found this time valuable. And if so, please, please, please share this podcast with colleagues and help promote the visibility of the podcast by liking, subscribing, and leaving quality 5-star reviews on your preferred listening platform. We hope you'll join us for the 2024 AMSSM Annual Meeting in Baltimore, Maryland, April 12th through the 17th. Please join us again soon for the next edition of the AMSSM Sports Medcast. The views expressed are ours alone and do not represent the official policy or position of the AMSSM, the Defense Health Agency, the U.S. Navy, U.S. Army, Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.